that what we're going to do, you guys listen to this, open 2, 3, 4, close 2, 3, 4. You ready?
That's the sound of the Lewisburg, Kansas high school band director instructing his marching band members on the choreography for a film shoot.
Things like that. Open again. Another move would be to rotate it.
He's having them, and stay with me here, open and close quilts, which they're holding by the corners in groups of four, rotating them one direction or the other, moving in circles.
Ready, go. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And we could do the reverse.
Eventually, they'll do all of this in a field, gathered around geometrically arranged tractors and pumpkins, filmed from an overhead drone, all under the guiding hand of Kansas City's David Wayne Reed.
And we'll count those all out. So it's very simple what we're doing. And
it's not just any field. It's on the family farm where David Wayne Reed grew up. And it's not just any film. It's Eternal Harvest, David's first film project, one that has taken this accomplished playwright and actor and storyteller and event producer literally back to his roots. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR Central Standard, we spend this hour on one of our portrait sessions. We're talking with David Wayne Reed about his life, telling stories. Today, as it often is, it's his story. David, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
It is really great to have you. We're going to talk a lot about Eternal Harvest, this latest project, later, but I'd love to start in the place where it all happens for that film and where it all started for you. Tell us about Lewisburg, Kansas.
Lewisburg, Kansas is my hometown, and my great-great-grandfather, Matthias, was really kind of the original Rockefeller of the town. He was very industrious, kind of a man of great vision, and a steamboat went down in the Mississippi River, and he got the engine and refurbished it, and that steam engine ran the first mill and later grain elevator of Lewisburg, Kansas, and that was a very successful operation, and then he started what would become the first bank with someone named Wright, so it was the Reed and Wright Bank, which is pretty clever.
Yes.
And we have multiple generations of farmers in our family ever since, and
And they're still there.
And they're still there. Yeah, my father and my mother still live on the family farm, as well as my cousin and my nephews are still in the area.
And when you were born there, and I how many years ago was that, give or take?
Almost 46 years ago.
Almost 46 years ago. What do you remember about being a kid in Lewisburg?
I remember it was a lot of hard work. And as kind of a slightly effeminate little kid, it was hard, it was masculine, and I didn't know that I really fit in. And so I kind of felt like a little bit of a square peg.
And was that something that you were feeling just inside, or were other people noticing that too?
Oh, I don't think I could hide it. In fact, I didn't hide it. I wanted to perform, and I knew my dad asked me when I was a little boy, I was sitting on his lap on the tractor, and he asked me if I wanted to be a farmer just like dad. And I said, no, I wanted to be a backup singer, a stripper, and an artist. And those were my earliest.
Well, in that order?
I think it was in that order. Those were my earliest career aspirations.
How'd your dad react to that?
I mean, how do you react? I don't know. Maybe thinking I'd just grow out of it, or I think he just was more concerned he needed help. And so where I wasn't really too strong to buck hay bales or, any of the other kind of harder, more mechanical work involved, I would perform. I would perform for the visiting seed salesman or for the hay crew doing choreographed dances for the hay crew, or donning my mom's heels and a wig and a cinched up shirt as a dress, and would perform for the seed salesman. honest to God.
They must have really looked forward to that.
I got a fiddle out of one of them.
No kidding.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
So, I mean, you were conscious of the disparity between your sort of identity about yourself and what maybe this world around you was expecting. What were there consequences to that? I mean, either emotional or in actual time, were you in danger? Were you harmed?
Well, I mean, not because of, I don't know, because of feeling effeminate, or just
yeah,
otherwise.
I mean, did it leave a mark?
Sure, I think so. It did leave a mark. I didn't know I was really gay until some bullies told me I was. and that was at school. And those were some of the other farm boys. And so it really kind of disconnected me even more. It's like, well, I don't want to hang out and do what these mean boys are doing and telling me. And so I didn't really feel like I had much of a place. But it wasn't really through my family. I didn't feel disconnected there. I felt that more from others, yeah, or kind of expectations.
Yeah. What did you feel from your family? How did they shape you during those early years of your life?
Well, they shaped me through hard work. I mean, you know, farming is a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week operation, and that hard work ethic, I think, definitely shaped me. I think they definitely shaped a semblance of spirituality and faith for me. And they've always been really very supportive of my artistic endeavors, even when they might not understand. They've showed up.
I know you've mentioned, I read somewhere that they came to a lot of your shows, which we'll get to a little later, but at the late night theater,
yeah,
which were very different than their experience in Lewisburg.
Sure. Well, it was, late night theater was very wild and out there, but I don't think it was entirely outside of their realm. You know, I found out years later that one of my parents' first dates was to go see Valley of the Dolls, mm-hmm, at the theater, which I loved. And, you know, we loved to watch Flip Wilson and Uncle Milton Berle, and they would dress in drag. So I don't feel like it was that far outside. You know, it was definitely more explicitly gay, mm-hmm, with late night theater, but they could handle it.
You mentioned spirituality and faith. How was that formed for you as a kid in Lewisburg?
Sure. Well, we went to the First Christian Church, and so I think I spent a lot of time going to the church, and that really formed me and my vision of what theater could be, mm-hmm, and also of what storytelling could be.
Say more about that.
Well, you know, there's the pastor, there's the audience, there's that kind of audience dynamic. There's also the theatricality of lighting the candles and setting the stage, the music, running kind of a program. You know, we'll know that we do communion. We have the doxology. You know, you have your final words. It's a script. It's a layout. So that definitely shaped me. And then I, you know, questioned all of that and threw that out and had to kind of start over again and find my own way back. But something that really stuck out to me as a young man, I asked my parents if they believed in reincarnation. And my mom said no, and my dad said yeah. And it really caught me off guard because it seemed like...
It caught your mom off guard too, it sounds like.
Oh, I don't know. You know, they tell each other everything. They're very close. But I said, oh, really? Well, why is that? And he said, well, take, for instance, a perennial plant or a volunteer crop of wheat. And that could be evidence for that. And that was a real aha moment for me, to look at the landscape and to agriculture as a lens into spirituality. I'd never thought about that before. And that really was the seedling for Eternal Harvest, in fact.
The work that you did on the farm as a kid, that your family did on the farm, and that you sort of participated in as you were able there as a kid, did that bear any resemblance to the kind of hard work that would later be required of you, whether it be in churning out scripts or preparing for an acting gig?
Absolutely. I'm an endurance creator. I will stay in it until the end. For better or worse, I will knuckle down and get the job done.
And what does that look like now? I mean, what's the equivalent of baling the hay into the night in your present reality?
Well, most recently I was editing the film and spending, you know, I taught myself how to edit. That was a completely new skill set that I'm barely above a novice now, but just taking on that new challenge, and it's like you're going to break it. It's almost like breaking an animal, I suppose. Mm-hmm. You're going to conquer it. And I would wake up at 5:30 in the morning, and I would go to bed at 12:30. You know, and that's not uncommon. You'd work all day on the farm, and you would have dinner at 9 o'clock, 9:30 at night, and then you would get up early and start again.
Yeah,
it's all the time. It's all consuming.
When you eventually you finish up with high school, you're starting to think about what your future is. When you were leaving high school, did you think, I'm done with Lewisburg, I'm getting out of this place?
Yes. Yes. I did. I wanted to be, well, first I wanted to be a journalist like you, Brian.
Oh, well, and, don't we all?
And then I received a theater scholarship to Emporia State University, and I went there for a year, but I was planning to transfer, and I did transfer to K-State to continue in journalism. And then when I got to K-State, I had a friend that I'd grown up with at my high school, and he's like, why don't you go check out the theater department? And I did, and I changed my major my junior year, and ended up getting my theater degree from the best veterinarian school in the nation, go K-State.
that renowned K-State theater program.
You know what? It actually is a very renowned, I mean, it's a very good program. I went to school with Eric Stone Street, you know, from Modern Family,
right.
And Jen Grace, who found some success on off-Broadway and television.
What was it that pulled you to theater at that point? I mean, you've already said you were entertaining people from your youngest days.
I just wanted to be in front of people. I just wanted to connect with people. Growing up on the farm, it's kind of lonely. You know, your only social outlets are going to church or going to the funeral home. That's what it felt like to me, you know. And so I was just desperate to connect with people in some way. And I wanted to, becoming an actor, I wanted to empathize with other kind of characters that I'd never really necessarily been around before. So it really opened up my view of the world.
I'm wondering if you started to see your town as something of a play filled with interesting characters and your farm as a stage.
Absolutely. No doubt about it. And in fact, a lot of my background was funneled into what would become Mother Trucker and Mother Trucker 2 Ride On, my On the Road Again trucking musicals.
Not to mention a monologue show.
Jolly Rancher.
Right.
Yeah, Jolly Rancher, my one-man show.
Well, we're going to talk about all of those shows and ask the question of how a person's own story can infuse the stories they tell about life and everything and everyone else. How does one find a home wherever one is? We'll continue our conversation with David Wayne Reed when KCUR Central Standard continues right after this. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison in for Gina Kaufman, and we're talking today in a portrait session with David Wayne Reed, known to Kansas City theater audiences for his writing and his performing, and maybe known soon for a film project he's undertaken called Eternal Harvest. We'll talk about that in a bit. But we've been talking about his life growing up in Lewisburg and his venture away to K-State, where he studied theater after first starting to study journalism. What did you start to learn when you got to a place like Manhattan, which is far more cosmopolitan, far more worldly than the place you came from?
Well, I learned how to party.
Let's
I learned
be honest.
To party at college. Yeah, I learned how to party, and I learned how to do monologues. And you know, I got my theater degree.
Yeah. What about doing monologues? Did you learn there that you didn't know from just talking a lot as a kid?
Well, I learned how to formalize it, you know, and beat my script, mark up my script, mark out beats, which is a way of marking up your script to show what objectives you want to play. And I'd never known that before.
Yeah.
So the technical aspect of the craft of acting. But it really allowed me a social life that I really hadn't had before. And it put me with other people like me.
Yeah.
That I didn't really have. There weren't, you know, we didn't really have a robust theater department at Lewisburg High School at that time. We would do one play a year. So, and those were usually plays by kids for kids. So doing actual play, titled plays that you'd heard of before, or doing a Sondheim musical or, you know, something like that. That was very exciting. And it really enlarged my vision of what, where I could be in theater.
It occurs to me that a lot of kids, a lot of college students go get their theater degree. That's a meaningful experience. It's interesting. It's fun. They graduate. And that's the last time they think about theater. They go on to get jobs doing something else. When did you know, no, I'm going to stay with this beyond college?
You know, I almost gave it up. And I graduated college in 94, and I had kind of given it up by 1996. And then there was a notice, an audition notice, I think in the pitch, for a show called The Birds. And I went and I auditioned, and that would later become late night theater. And so I kind of walked in on the ground floor of late night theater, and then that really put me on the map.
Late night theater in Kansas City, but you tried to get away, right? You tried to head west.
I did try to head west, and I got as far as About Truth and Consequences, New Mexico, and ran out of money.
Aptly named.
I know, and that was the truth and the consequence. And I had to return to Kansas City kind of with my tail between my legs. I moved back home, and I would go out to our silo, and I would shout Shakespearean monologues, or I think I was doing an Eric Bogosian monologue around that time, or I would just sing my guts out in the silo every night because the acoustics were so good.
Sure.
And
it's a lot bigger than the shower.
It's a lot bigger than the shower, and it really amplified my voice, and that really set me on this path, and I just stuck with it. You know, you get in so far, and it just becomes a part of you.
Mm-hmm.
It just becomes something that you've got to do. Like, you know, my dad has retired a lot from what he's done on the farm, but it's so ingrained in him. Like, he still does it because what else are you going to do?
You know, it occurs to me that you're pretty well known around Kansas City, but you almost didn't get back here. You went back home to Lewisburg, and where could have been a rural guy, or could you have been?
I don't think at that point in my life I could have been.
Yeah.
I had a lot of stuff that I needed to work out, and I needed to experience.
Yeah. So you got the part. You became part of one of the founding members of late night theater.
Yes.
Tell people about the beginnings of late night theater. What, and for those who don't know what late night theater is, to explain it in a word or two.
Okay. Well, late night theater is a kind of gender bending theater troupe. When we started out, it was an all male troupe, and we did send ups of famous movies like The Birds, Valley of the Dolls, Stepford Wives, on and on and on. And it was there that kind of studying these scripts and seeing how they were adapted, it really taught me how playwriting worked and dramatic structure worked. And so I kind of tossed my hat in the ring and created I wrote Come Back to the 9 to 5, Dolly Parton, Dolly Parton, a send up of 9 to 5, and Come Back to the 5 and Dime, Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean. And that was my first play that I, air quotes, wrote, adapted for the stage. And that was just prior to what would become the 9 to 5 musical. It's kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I also did the show formerly known as Purple Rain, using an all-female cast. I thought it would be funny because it's such a misogynistic script to have it portrayed by all female. And that really got some traction. That won a best of from the Star. And there was another show. Oh, Supermodels in Space, and that I collaborated with one of the other founding members, John Piggy Cupid. And then I really turned my attention toward original scripts, and I wanted to tap into the genre of trucker movies, like the old Smokey and the Bandits and Convoy and all that. And so I really mined my own history for that and came up with Mother Trucker, and then its sequel, Mother Trucker 2 Ride On.
How do you think Mother Trucker represented kind of the first time that you were really drawing on your own experiences?
Absolutely. And it was an incredibly emotional experience. The night that opened, I remember the audience, you know, applauded and stood up. And I went out to the back alley of the theater, and I just wept. I couldn't even go out for the encore, because you put so much work into it, and then it's also so personal. It's your life that you're pouring into this. And to see it accepted and validated in such a warm, engaged way was really special to me. That was a real big turning point for me.
Did you ever turn back? I mean, do you feel like all the rest of your work has had that infusion of you?
Absolutely. That's when it started to get personal. That and then Jolly Rancher, of course, What Do You Call a Gay Farmer, a Jolly Rancher? That was my one-man show. And I debuted it in Seaside, Florida. I had received a residency at Escape to Create in Florida in 2012. And I had pitched to them in my proposal, my application, that I wanted to work on a story and that would later become part of a one-man show. And I received a Google alert one day that said, David Wayne Reed brings his one-man show, Jolly Rancher, to our community. I'm like, oh. Deep breaths, you know, and they were charging money for it. So I remember I arrived there on January 3rd and my show was on January 19th. And so I had to fashion a one-man show really quickly. And it was to a community of strangers. You know, anyone that I was in the audience for that, the longest I'd known anyone in there was 2 weeks.
And not only strangers, but from a whole different part of the country that doesn't appreciate the culture and the background.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I just got up with my script on the podium and delivered about an hour, 45-minute show. And people laughed and people cried and people were into it. People were moved. And it confounded me, because I thought, I'm just sharing who I am. It seemed so personal to me. And it was the first time that I realized that the personal is the universal. And I've carried that thread on, you know, I reprised Jolly Rancher a few times since then. And have carried that into storytelling ventures that I'd done with, you know, Gina Kaufman and different literary deathmatch and on and on.
You know, the personal is the universal, you've said, and it's easy to see how that is an affirming thing to know and to experience when you're telling stories, you're making yourself vulnerable, and people are applauding and laughing and crying with you. What about when it doesn't go as well? I mean, have you ever made yourself vulnerable and felt like, you know, they're not just rejecting my work, they're rejecting me?
No, I haven't. I haven't felt that, because truly the gift for me is is the accountability of sharing it. And so it's, you know, you can either get on board, but you don't have to. But luckily I haven't had that experience. I don't know how that sounds. But.
Well, no. I mean, if you haven't, you have it. That's great. You've another of your sort of personal experiences that you've shared in later comedic form is about a self-help seminar you were part of, the show, the play Help Yourself.
Yes. Well, so as a young man, I was seeking. I was looking to become better, and I was drafted into this opportunity to do this weekend transformational retreat, and I did it, and it seemed to lend itself to theatricality in the same way that the church lends itself to theatricality.
So give us a picture. What was the original retreat? Like, what was the idea? How was it advertised?
Sure. Well, I mean, do you want to live in a world of possibilities? Do you want to, you know, do you want to be a better you? All of that. I mean, it's called kind of these Oprah-isms, really. Mm-hmm. And of course, who doesn't want to be a better version of themselves?
And you signed up to really, because you really wanted to be a better version of yourself, or because you thought it sounded amazing?
Yes, I did. Okay. I'd gone through a really hard time at that time, and so I was kind of coming out of that, and yeah, I was looking for something. And so I did the weekend retreat, and I think you'd asked, what does it look like? So there are about, I don't know, maybe 150, 175 people in chairs in a room, and then there's a kind of leader and microphones, really kind of like an elaborate Oprah set. Mm-hmm. And people get up and share their issues, and the leader helps you walk through those to really get to the meat of what's happening.
You were comparing it to church. Is it the same?
You know, I think people were actually brought to bigger aha moments than maybe they are in churches sometimes. I think that we go to churches kind of by rote, and you just kind of go just to go and satisfy being seen, or just out of tradition. Whereas I think people went to this because they really wanted a big change. Mm-hmm. And you saw that. You saw that happen with people, and that people would just so bravely share their kind of their darkest stuff publicly. It showed me the power of how personal you could get and how universal that is. All of our negative emotions and all that stuff, really, it all boils down to kind of the same stuff. When you really kind of get all of the narrative out of the way, a lot of it comes down to being guilty or shameful or not good enough or whatever it is.
And so you take an experience like that, which is powerful, but not necessarily entertaining. It's not laugh a minute necessarily. You turn it into something that that people pay money to come and see. Can you walk us through how you get there from A to B there?
Well, I wanted to create an experience. I always want to create an experience and a space to allow people to feel and to be introspective about their own lives. And I'd found that in storytelling. And so I created my own self-help group called Understanding Simplified. And it was us. Join mm-hmm. us. But really the main curriculum was that we are all just a bunch of pronouns stumbling through this life, and we're looking for the next plot point. And we can rewrite our lives. I think my guy said, life gets exciting when you start rewriting. And about how we can rewrite our stories, and we can share our stories. So that was really the jumping off point. And I made people feel a part of it because I blurred the line between what was theatrical and what was actually happening in the room. And the audience members, I made them wear Hello, My Name Is badges and sign their names on it. It was like the first step of accountability. And so they would sit in the audience with their names shared on their collars. And the Gabe Newland, the guru, he would walk through and he could pick on people and say, Ashley, you know, why are you not living your best life? Mark, where did it all go wrong for you? And that was scripted. But people, he didn't expect an answer, but sometimes people gave an answer and it became really real. And people were like, oh my God, this is real. And this is in my backyard. I can't just sit there and be a part of the audience, just being a voyeur. I'm drawn into the experience and I'm thinking about, okay, well, where did it go wrong for me? Was it because I didn't have enough money? Is it because dad shot himself? Is it because of, you know, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And so there were like two shows going on.
There's the scripted show, and then there's the real show.
And it was a dark comedy. I mean, I painted it to be so serious. I mean, it did. That's why it was a dark comedy. It was serious.
I'm curious. We've talked mostly about shows that were deeply personal for you, and sometimes you were in those, like Jolly Rancher, and sometimes you have other actors playing those roles about your life. But I'm curious what it's like for you when you do more traditional acting, which I know you've done some of as well, where you're playing roles that are not about you. Is that something you even want to do anymore?
I haven't.
Yeah.
I haven't done it in a while. I retired unofficially. I don't know. I won't say never again. I really enjoyed it, and I've done it, but I like creating.
Yeah.
I want to write the words. I've found that it's made me more particular about what scripts I want to do. The last time I acted was in a really great show. It was called An Otherwise Hopeless Evening, and it was at the Provincetown Tennessee Williams International Theater Festival, and it was a show that started out here in Kansas City in the former Jewel Box Theater, which was where the drag queens thrived for many decades down on Troost. And I wasn't a part of the original production, but then was cast to fill in for a role, and it was one of the highlights of my theatrical career. And that was in fall of 14. And if that was my swan song, then that's
okay
fine.
That.
Yeah.
As you look back over the course of all of your professional work, from those early parody shows at late night theater to the work you're doing now, how do you feel like your work has evolved? How are you different today than you were 20 some years ago?
Well, I think I'm more in control of where my career is going. I think that's what I didn't like about acting, is that I'm susceptible to someone else's whims. You know, they might not cast me for whatever reason, you know, whatever that may be. It can be, you know, I'm too tall, I'm too bald, I'm too, you know, any number of things. Whereas creating, I have more control over my career destiny rather than waiting for someone to offer me the opportunities. I'll just create them myself.
Would you have been 20 years ago able to exert that kind of control? Would you have been willing to take that kind of charge of your career?
I don't think so. I didn't know that was a possibility.
Yeah.
At that point, you know, late night theater taught me a lot about resourcefulness and that DIY kind of let's put on a show. And you know, it's funny, when I was growing up on the farm, I was a slightly effeminate kid and afraid of power tools and all of that. And then late night theater, we would climb up in heels and have power tools, you know, drilling up stuff and putting, I learned more about my own masculinity by wearing a dress and heels, to be honest. Yeah.
I'm curious what you also learned about family and about community, because we talked in the first part of the show about, you know, those things you gained from growing up on the farm with your family in Lewisburg. What did you find for family, for community, in these years in the Kansas City theater scene?
Sure. Well, you know, late night was definitely a close-knit family during my time there. So I really was able to move from one family to another and develop really close collaborative relationships.
Family was my word. Is that the right word? Does that describe it well?
Sure, I think so. Yeah.
What was family about it?
You know, we would fight, we would party, we would also be there for each other. And we would get the job done. You know, we were all working toward a common goal of creating a show. And that binds you. That definitely draws you together.
Well, let's take one more break. When KCUR Central Standard continues, we'll turn to David Wayne Reed's most recent project. It's a unique one for him. It's his first film. It's also not so much about the words as about images and movement. It's taking him back to the fields and family of Lewisburg, Kansas again. We'll hear about it. I'm Brian Ellison. Stay with us. Welcome back to our portrait session with David Wayne Reed. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. David Wayne Reed has had a life spent in the Kansas City theater scene, and it's still going strong, that life. Now he's moved on to a new kind of project. It's called Eternal Harvest. Talk to us about what this is. What led you to take on something as different as this project?
Sure. Well, Eternal Harvest is a film project using drones, heirloom quilts, dance, agriculture, and video installation that documents the cycle of life as told by the growing season on my family's rural Kansas farm. The idea was born on Father's Day of 2016 when my Aunt Orpha passed away. And the family gathered out on the farm, and I remember it was the most spectacularly beautiful day I ever remember on the farm. The wheat was just such a beautiful gold. The sky was the perfect blue. The pastures were beautiful green. And I wanted to capture that beauty because I knew that the cycle of life was turning. Aunt Orpha had just passed. My youngest nephew, Colby, had cancer. His cancer had returned. And my parents were growing older. I was growing older. And I wanted to document this time before it was lost. You know, we all know that family farms have been on the decline for you know, decades now. And I wanted to capture that before it all was gone. A month later, my nephew and I went out, my eldest nephew, Lenny, and I went out to Colorado on a little weekend vacation, and he had just bought a drone, picked up a drone from a buddy of his, and he was showing me what it could do, and it was really cool. And so on the drive across Kansas, I pitched him an idea of I wanted to use the drone and maybe we could document all of my grandma's beautiful heirloom quilts, of which there were like 100 left over. And I wanted to do something with that. That's all I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And then the idea just kind of started to take root and grew to be something much bigger. And I started thinking about the cycle of life and thinking about what my dad had told me when I asked him about reincarnation, which I had mentioned earlier. And that really became kind of the narrative, if there is one, for the film.
And you say there's not, you say if there is one, it isn't.
Well, there is a narrative.
It isn't a traditional narrative with characters and plot, but talk about how there is one in the film anyway.
Well, I document what happens the season of life, but really from the shovel that digs to bury to the shovel that digs to plant. That's the timeline of the piece. I purposely tied my writer hands behind my back and wanted to solely communicate in a visual language. And as a longtime writer and not a visual artist, that was not my strong suit at all. Anyone who's seen me draw anything knows that that is not my strong suit.
How did you even conceive? I mean, you normally sit down, I assume, either with pen and paper or at a keyboard and start writing. What did you do for this?
Well, I draw. Yeah. Actually, I'm terrible at it, but I draw these kindergarten kind of looking sketches, and luckily I have people, collaborators that help pull off my vision. That's where I started. A lot of it was just letting the landscape tell me what story it wanted to tell. It was really about making a documentary. It was kind of like making what I would imagine a reality television show. You document all of it. You film, and then once you have all of that, then you start to formulate a story out of it. So it was completely contrary to, you know, writing Help Yourself, say. You write the script, and then you build the... You put all the visual bells and whistles on it later. Mm-hmm. This was all the visuals first and story later.
How long did it take you to shoot all the film that you wanted to use?
Sure. We shot from the beginning of May of 2017. I received a rocket grant from the Warhol Foundation and Charlotte Street and Spencer Museum to launch this. And so we started shooting in May. And then we ended this May of 17, and then we ended shooting March 31st of this year.
And the project, you know, for people who have not seen it or seen clips from it, and they should, or actually go out and see
it. Yeah, check out the trailer.
Yeah, but it's you use a variety of visual images. Talk about how you went about shooting some of these. I mean, you involved in that, as we heard at the beginning of the show today, you involved a lot of people from the Lewisburg community.
I did. You know, I'd be remiss to say I was really moved by the geometric patterns of my grandmother's quilts, as well as mandalas, mm-hmm. Which is Hindu or Buddhist kind of representation of the cycle of life. So it involved a lot of circles. And I knew that I wanted to display my grandma's quilts in a large scale way. I envisioned them in the pasture, and several people walking them around in circles and creating a mandala out of agricultural equipment and just what was of the season. And so I knew I wanted to collaborate with my high school band director, Mr. Chissetti, because I needed to I wanted to engage with the community, and I wanted people who knew how to move and took direction well. And over one quarter of Lewisburg High School's population is in the marching band. And they just got back from the Rose Bowl parade earlier this year.
It's a well-regarded band.
Really very well-regarded band. I really struck gold in working with him. And I treated him to dinner at Olive Garden out in Overland Park and pitched him the idea and showed him my kind of kindergarten sketches of what I was looking for. And we formulated a plan and came out to the farm, and we shot that whole sequence. There were 75 people, 20 quilts, and 6 tractors, and 100 pumpkins. And we shot it in and cleaned up. Everything was in and out in 2 hours.
Wow.
It was pretty incredible.
Was there an element of it, and I know Lewisburg is not like it's in a different country. It's not that far from Kansas City. And yet you are so identified with being kind of this urban guy, part of this city theater scene. Mm. What was it like to go back there and be doing your work, your art, but in that setting, which was where you grew up and where, you know, at a time where for a lot of your life you were entertaining there, but it wasn't working. It didn't seem like you fit in.
It felt like coming home. I mean, literally and creatively, that's where I started. That's where I was creating anyway. If I wasn't performing on a hay bale wagon, you know, dancing for the hay crew, or you know, doing drag for the seed salesman, or performing monologues in the silo, it's just part of me to create on that land. So it was really a prodigal return,
mm-hmm.
and it was just as comfortable as anything. The richest part of the whole experience was the journey. You know, last weekend we premiered the film out on the farm, but I was already proud of it because I was already proud of the lead up to it. I was so proud of how my nephew, you know, he'd never made a film before. He'd never shot a film. He just got this drone, and watching his growth and his interest in that, seeing how my mom's and my dad's creativity was stoked and all the great ideas that they brought forward to it. My dad is kind of the star of the film.
How so?
Well, it's, you know, it's the cycle of life told through the farmer's eyes. So it starts with him walking into the cornfield, which is, you know, it could be heaven. It could be the bardo, according to the Tibetan Book of the Dead. That space in between death and rebirth. And so he starts it out. And so.
You know, you compared it, your story in going back there to the prodigal, that biblical parable of the son who returns after a life spent out in debauchery and profligate living.
That is exactly right.
Does that capture your life exactly?
Yeah.
But that story is about kind of the reactions that happen when he comes back. There's the father who warmly embraces him, and then there's his older brother who's like, yeah, I've been here working hard this whole time. Do you feel like there's any kind of resentment from people back home?
No, I don't at all. No, my spending this premiere this past weekend, we were part of the Miami County Farm Tour, and it was such a great moment. My entire family was involved helping out. It was all hands on deck, and it was a really special weekend for the family. I felt nothing but love and pride. It was awesome.
How will the experience of viewing that film, that installation in other places, be different from actually getting to see it out on the farm?
I think if you missed it out on the farm, you missed a really amazing opportunity. I don't mean to be however
sorry,
about
everyone.
That, but it was really special because it was site specific.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing it on the space where it was shot was. And along with all of my grandmother's quilts displayed in the shed with all of my dad's his impressive array of antique tractors that he maintains meticulously.
Which make an appearance in that mandala, in that film, that scene filmed with the drone.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Do you, you are going to be, where else will people be able to see this, this film?
Well, gosh, I just made it. So I am figuring that out. As it turns out, marketing a film is a lot different than marketing theater, so I'm really finding my footing with that. I do know that it is being shopped out to museums and libraries and organizations around the country as part of Exhibits USA through Mid-America Arts Alliance. It will also play on June 23rd at the Tivoli at 1:30 p.m. as part of the Out Here Now Film Festival. And I'm looking to pitch it to all the film festivals. So that's my job in the next week, to do that research.
The film is about the cycle of life. You said the shovel that buries to the shovel that plants.
Yes.
Where do you feel like you are in that cycle?
I'm in the summer of my life. I mean, this is the, I think this is the fruiting. I don't know. I feel like this is a real blossoming time.
Yeah. Does it make you more reflective about your own life to be doing projects like this?
Oh, my God. Yes, absolutely. You know, poring over the footage and spending so much time out on the farm over the course year, you know, we were very diligent about getting out there at least once a month to shoot footage, and spending a lot of time with my parents and my family. And as I see my parents aging, and you know, it's very close. And I see that in myself as well. It was very emotional editing it. You know, you watch your father walk into the cornfield enough times, you can't help but think about his death, your own death. I mean, that's just the cycle of life. That's just how it goes.
So what is next in the life of David Wayne Reed? Is this the beginning of a prolific film career, or are we going
to... Well, we'll have to wait and see. I'm taking a well-deserved rest after this and putting more marbles toward the marketing of it. You know, I my show Shelf Life...
This is a storytelling event that you have periodically in the Kansas City area.
Yes, I do that bi-monthly. It's like Show and Tell meets The Moth or This American Life. And that's been going on for a couple of years. I'll be completing my second season on June 9th. And so I will be announcing the third season and keep on keeping on.
Actor and playwright, storyteller, and now producer and director, David Wayne Reed. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you, Brian. What an honor to be here.
And an honor for us. This has been a portrait session, which means that David Wayne Reed's story will be online later today, along with photographs by the very talented Paul Andrews. You can get all of that and the audio of today's show at kcur.org/centralstandard. All our other shows are there too, kcur.org/centralstandard. This is the weekend now, so if you need some good listening material between now and Monday, or if you just miss Gina Kaufman's voice, check out the Midwesternish podcast. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts, or download episodes at kcur.org. Our show is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, and Coy Duggar. This week, we've also had help from Linda Scher and our now-departed intern, Matt Groby. Thanks for everything, Matt. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs, and Paul Andrews is our portrait session partner. I'm Brian Ellison. Have a great weekend, and now stay tuned for Up to Date.